You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Here's an update from a conversation we had last month. I talked to UW-Platteville professor Andrei Ivanov, who is in Poland helping his parents escape from Ukraine and the Russian invasion. He and his parents are in Wisconsin now. WPR's Jonah Blekas caught up with them and wrote a piece at WPR.org with more details about their journey out of their home country. You can find that at WPR.org/Central Time. Look for the related links section. You can also listen back there to my interview with him. Now, we here at Central Time enjoy our movies, as we know a lot of you do too. In the past, we've talked about the all-time great movie musicals, animated pictures, movie soundtracks, and more. Today, we put the spotlight on another big part of cinema, foreign language films. You might have noticed some more recognition for these movies at the Oscars in the last couple of years. Drive My Car and Minari were recent nominees for Best Picture. In 2019, Parasite became the first foreign language film to take home the Best Picture title. But there's a world of movies out there. Where do you start? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite foreign language films? If you do watch them, do you remember the first movie you saw that was in another language? Have you seen any of those recent foreign language Oscar nominees? If you avoid them, what's the biggest barrier for you? And if English isn't your first language, what was your first exposure to English language movies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She wrote the book The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here as always, Rob.
Let's start with the elevator pitch, Jocelyn, for somebody who's maybe reluctant to check out films that aren't in their native language. Let's say English for now. Make the case of what we have to gain.
Yeah, you know, there are so many ways to tell a story out there, and they really are not restricted to the way that we tend to do it in English-speaking film, whether it's American or Canadian or films made in the UK or anything like that. If you restrict yourself to just those kinds of narrative, you're missing out on the absolutely massive amount of film that's available from around the world. And right now, with all sorts of streaming accessibility, this world is available right at our fingertips. It's just a watershed moment for having access to films from all around the world. It's the perfect time to get started. And if you don't do this, well, you miss out on ways that culture is just this incredibly constantly evolving and moving thing. We might recognize national borders as things that are kind of rigid, but culture doesn't. And so it's a really great time to open yourself up to all the different ways that you can experience how stories are told from around the world.
And as I understand it, you know, Hollywood movies and other film traditions, they kind of talk to each other and influence each other and shape each other. Where can we go to see some of the things that might have influenced some of the movies we've seen and vice versa?
Yeah, this is such a wonderful example of how English language film, especially for our case, Hollywood film, has an impact on foreign language film. And then foreign language film has an impact on what happens here as well. So one of the great examples we can think about is the French New Wave in the 1950s and 60s. And we think about this as kind of like the height of intellectual filmmaking, right? Jean-Luc Godard, François Truffaut, they really transform how we understand how movies work. But this didn't come about generous, right? They didn't just like come out of nowhere developing this. They were actually deeply inspired by American filmmakers like Orson Welles or John Ford, even Charlie Chaplin, Howard Hawks, right? So if we think about somebody like Godard and his really, really famous film Breathless from 1960, which really puts the French New Wave on the map around the world, that film is deeply inspired by American film noir, right? And later he makes things like Alphaville, which is of course very influenced by science fiction, especially American science fiction. Or we can think about other films that move from language to language, something like one of the first foreign language films that I saw, Purple Noon from 1960, which is directed by René Clément. That was made in French as well as Italian and English, but it was based on Patricia Highsmith's novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley, which was written in English. And then, of course, that novel is then remade into another movie in 1999 called The Talented Mr. Ripley that is made in English. So we can see that there's always this kind of like back and forth conversation. And it's really a wonderful way to understand how these stories transform via different directors and different filmmakers in different parts of the world.
We are talking to UW-Milwaukee film professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies. She is begging and pleading with us to check out some foreign language movies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to watch foreign language films? You can name names if you have favorites. Do you want some suggestions? You like this, so what might you like? Jocelyn might well have an answer for you. Are the subtitles an obstacle? They are for a lot of people. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Jocelyn, the subtitles are a hurdle. It seems like an extra work sometimes. Some people in my household, I won't name names, so they sometimes watch phones while they're watching films on the TV. I don't know. How do we overcome that subtitle hesitation if we have that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wish I could solve the scourge of people looking at their phones while they're watching movies, but that's beyond the foreign language problem, right? But I understand this, and I actually get it from my students too, many of whom have never seen a foreign language film before they come into a film studies classroom. And I think there's a lot more of anxiety around subtitles than there really, really needs to be. The number one thing that I always tell my students and that I would tell anybody who's feeling a little bit reluctant to dive in is just not to stress it so much. You know, a good filmmaker is going to provide you with so many visual and oral cues for what's happening that extend beyond what the characters are seeing. It's really important for us to remember that film is not literature. The words matter, the script matters, but it is definitely not the only thing going on. So if you miss something, that's okay, because you're going to get most of it in context. And I'll give you a little example, because Parasite, you know, just really burst onto the scene and really transformed, I think, a lot of American spectators' relationship with foreign films. There's that wonderful moment where the Kim family, who are the kind of protagonists of the film, where they're leaving the rich family's house in the middle of a rainstorm. And we watch them move from this gorgeous, spectacular, wealthy, you know, exquisite house that's kind of like at the top of this hill, literally down into the urban depths. We follow them over the course of several minutes during this rainstorm as they move into like increasingly dirtier and more cramped urban situations until finally they're at their very dingy basement apartment that's flooded. Very little is said in that sequence, but we learn everything we need to know about the family's class and position just from watching them move through the city. And that's what a good filmmaker will give you. You don't have to stress so much about trying to catch everything. You're going to understand it from the entirety of the context.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Madison. Lori, hi.
Hi. In the 70s, I saw a film called La Cage aux Folles, and it was subtitled. And later it was made into a blockbuster hit with Robin Williams called The Birdcage. And I really think that there was a lot lost in the translation from the French to the English version.
Lori, thanks a lot for that call. I think I seem to recall the original of that was actually fairly successful, as foreign language films go, in the U.S., Jocelyn.
It was. And I think that's an example of how certain genres can make foreign language films really appealing too, right? Because that relies very, very much on the musical, right? That is a musical and there's a lot of music in it. And music is also something that expresses emotion past what the words are saying. So it's a great example of how a film that might be shot in a foreign language can provide additional information beyond the verbal to give us insight into what's actually happening in the story.
Thanks for the call, Lori. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, UW-Milwaukee film studies professor, about foreign language movies, where to start, why it's worth it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you seek out foreign language movies? Is it an area you still want to explore? Do you have a favorite, a country of origin for movies made outside of the United States? Name names, recommend movies, 800-642-1234, or ask for suggestions, 800-642-1234. We'll get some suggestions coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about international films and movies and languages other than English with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in with a movie to recommend, a question. If you need a recommendation, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Jocelyn, want to get into some of your recommendations. Now, you had one, a Japanese director named Kurosawa. And I'm like, oh, I heard him. Nope, not that one. Kiyoshi Kurosawa. Tell us a bit about his movies and why they might be a good starting point.
Absolutely. I mean, you can watch Akira Kurosawa. He's perfectly good, too. But Kiyoshi Kurosawa is one of my favorite filmmakers. And the reason I wanted to talk about him a little bit is kind of relevant in terms of what our caller just talked about, which is that he is a fabulous genre filmmaker. So there's two films that I'd point to in terms of ways to get your feet wet with foreign language films. The first one is his film Pulse from 2001, and this is a horror movie, but it's a movie about ghosts on the internet. And so it's really, really prescient because it contains all these anxieties, these kind of like millennial anxieties around what the internet means and how we might lose ourselves and all become kind of like spirits or ghosts moving through the internet. It's so prescient. It's really, really scary. And it's a wonderful example of the absolutely fantastic ghost movies that have been coming out of Japan for decades. I mean, if you're a horror fan and you're not watching Japanese cinema, you're totally missing out. But he's also really good at melodrama. And in 2008, he makes this absolutely gorgeous family drama called Tokyo Sonata, which is about a family, a pretty average upper middle class family in Tokyo, where the father loses his job during the recession, but he pretends to keep going to work, and all of these kinds of rippling effects that this has on his entire family. And it's a real weepy movie. It is absolutely gorgeous. And you could hold it up next to any exquisite family drama coming out of Hollywood.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. So one of the foreign language film I just recently watched in the past 6 months or so was a film called White Tiger. It's a Russian World War II movie, and the general concept is there is a white German tiger tank that will suddenly appear on the battlefield as almost like a ghost. It comes in, slaughters the other side, and then disappears. And at the end, there's this duel between a Russian and this German tank. And yes, it did have subtitles, but you know, after a while, you get used to those. And I would highly recommend that one.
Thanks a lot for that call. That's a great moment when I have watched movies with subtitles where it hits me. I forgot I was watching subtitles, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that's when you're really, you've like hit the kind of flow state, right? It's like everything is working in conjunction with everything else in a really, really beautiful way. That's part of why I encourage people who are a little anxious about this, just not to stress it so much, because you will get to that point. You definitely will get to that point.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. White Tiger. Jerry joins us now in La Crosse. Jerry, hi.
Yeah. Hi, thanks. I just love foreign movies. It's almost all I ever watch nowadays. I'm sort of tired of all the explosions and, you know, shootings and all that sort of thing. But I wish I could think of more. I've got hundreds of them that I love. But one I can think of right now is, I think I'm not here anymore. I am not here anymore. It's about a sort of a cult of music fans from Mexico. I don't know if, I hope I have that name right.
I'd look it up. I'm no longer here. Could that be it?
That's it. I'm no longer here.
Excellent. Jerry, thanks. That's I'm no longer here from Mexico. Any Spanish language movies? They'd probably have a decent audience, Jocelyn, without subtitles in the U.S. Anything from Mexico or beyond you'd point us toward?
Oh, wow. I mean, so, so much. One of the greatest living filmmakers right now is, of course, Pedro Almodovar, the wonderful Spanish director who's had just a many decades. I mean, almost a 50-year career so far. He's been working for so long. So one of the films of his that I really, really, really love is All About My Mother or Talk to Her. They're just gorgeous films that one of the things that's so wonderful about them is that he has really fabulous leading lady protagonists. He's a male director who absolutely loves his female stars. And that's how people like Penelope Cruz, Javier Bardem, you know, all these amazing actors get their start working with Almodovar.
Thanks a lot for that call. David joins us next in Phillips. David, hi.
Hey, hi. There's one in a sequel. In French, it's La Source, or The Source, and its follow-up movie called Manon of the Strings. This is a series of movies that is an amazing family saga and has many nuances and depth to it. I think many people will enjoy it.
Any big names in that one, David?
Yeah, Gérard Depardieu, a young Gérard Depardieu, and a French actress, I can't remember her name, very famous actress. People will know when they see it.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, David. Yeah, French movies. They've made a movie or two, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no such thing as the tradition of French cinema. One of the things that I'd love to point out with French cinema, and this is honestly, Rob, this is one of my favorite things to tell people about foreign films, is that, you know, we think of them as like the height of urbane sophistication, right? The French, they're so much better than we are. They eat all that butter and they don't gain weight, right? But when French films really hit the mainstream in the second wave of cinephilia in the 50s and 60s, they're not just promoted as something that a very intellectual audience would go to. They're also promoted because they have a lot more nudity in them than American films did at the time. So somebody like Roger Vadim makes the film And God Created Woman in 1956, which is famous for really kickstarting Brigitte Bardot's career. And I'm sure all I have to say is Brigitte Bardot, and you understand what a very, very sexy movie this is. And this was promoted not just as something that you would go see because it's a classy French movie, but actually because you'd see quite frank eroticism in it in a way that you would not see American movies at the time. So even though we think of foreign language films as something that like, oh, we go see that if we want to think that we're really, really intellectual audiences, they're also something that have often been marketed as something quite lascivious and risk-taking as well.
Thanks for that call, David. We're talking about foreign language movies with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Maquonago. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you got for us, Tom?
My absolute favorite foreign film is a film called Babette's Feast. It was made, gosh, I want to say it was made in the 70s or 80s. It's a Danish film, all subtitled, but very international cast in it. You know, has people that come in for an opera singer that sings in Paris, and then a whole bunch of different things. And it's about a chef that escapes the revolution and ends up in Jutland. So it's just a wonderful film.
Tom, thanks. That was a pretty big name. I haven't seen it myself, Jocelyn, but I remember that getting a lot of hullabaloo.
Yeah, that was a really, really popular film. And I actually love that example. It's a beautiful film, but it's a great example of how we can use our other senses to get into a foreign language film. Because, of course, that culminates in this incredible sequence of cooking and eating, right? So it really is something that's trying to evoke the sensory pleasures and experiences of good food, good wine, and company. And those are not dependent upon understanding the same language. So I think that's a really wonderful example of how a foreign language film can appeal to all manner of our senses and not just the way that we speak.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Something that's nagging at me, Jocelyn, one of our callers earlier said he got into foreign films to get away from the shooting and explosions in American movies. My most sustained watching of foreign films was back in the day with my buddies. We'd watch the Hong Kong shoot 'em up genre, the John Woo and other directors. Lots of shooting and explosions in them. Like, we could find that stuff in foreign language films too, right?
Oh my gosh, of course. I mean, John Woo is a wonderful example, or Beat Takeshi, right, who makes these wonderful gangster Japanese movies as well. Not quite as acrobatic as the amazing fight choreography that we get in John Woo, but Beat Takeshi, his films are just full of, you know, a lot of violence, definitely a lot of violence, but they're also these kind of searching movies about like what it means to be a part of the criminal underworld. We definitely do not have the only violent images here. There's plenty to be found in foreign language films as well.
Now, before we run out of time, Jocelyn, you are hosting the first of two virtual screenings of a Ukrainian movie. Can you tell us what's going on?
Absolutely. The first screening is going to happen on Thursday of this week, and the second will be on April 25th. And this is a brand new Ukrainian film. It's a historical adventure set in the early 17th century. And it's about a group of Cossacks and this gold that they've been tasked to transport between the Ukrainian and Polish border. The film is supposed to premiere this year. Obviously, that's been put into a very tenuous situation because of the invasion and the horrible war in Ukraine, but we've gotten access to this film. So there will be a virtual premiere on Thursday and on April 25th. And it begins with a roundtable conversation that I had with the filmmaker and the executive producer who are currently in Kyiv. So it's a great opportunity to see a film that you would not have access to any other way.
We've got a link to registration for that screening up at WPR.org/Central Time. Again, WPR.org/Central Time. Our last half a minute or so, Jocelyn, name one more name that you think we ought to check out in the foreign language world.
Okay, I will say We Are the Best, which is Lukas Moodysson's film from 2013. He's a Swedish director known for all sorts of genres, but this is an absolute delight of a film that is a comedy about teen girls, young teen girls who start their own punk band because they're very, very angry at their very normal suburban life. And it is a delight from start to finish.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you so much. I love being on.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us today for a look at how to get into movies from other countries and other languages and maybe why we should. Hey, there's still time for you to share your recommendations for everyone else. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. When the U.S. Senate confirmed Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination to become the next Supreme Court justice, she became the first Black woman to be confirmed for that position.
It has taken 232 years and 115 prior appointments for a Black woman to be selected to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States. But we've made it.
That's the newly confirmed Justice Jackson speaking at the White House last week. She's also the first justice since Thurgood Marshall, another first, the first Black person to ascend to the high court, to have experience as a public defender. We're going to talk about the public defender side of the story in just a bit. But first, what does Jackson's confirmation mean for Black women in the legal profession here in Wisconsin? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts, what responses have you had to Justice Jackson's confirmation? What feelings has it brought up for you? If you work in the legal field or the criminal justice system, what thoughts do you have? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amber Rafit August is president of the Wisconsin Association of African American Lawyers and an attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. Amber, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, part of your group's work includes encouraging more Black people to enter the legal field. Can you talk first a bit about the gap you see in representation around Wisconsin?
So just generally, there just aren't a lot of, especially Black women attorneys, Black women judges. The current administration obviously has been making a push to diversify the bench through a lot of the new appointments, but it's still a very small group, not really visible. So the idea of having an associate justice of the Supreme Court in this newest justice is just, I was thinking about it and the feelings of just joy and excitement and talking with other Black attorneys, especially Black women attorneys that I interact with Wall and outside of Wall, everyone's just so excited about the representation, but there's still so much more that needs to happen in Wisconsin.
President Biden talked about representation last week at the White House, flanked by the newly confirmed Justice Jackson and Vice President Kamala Harris. Here's some of what he had to say.
Look, it's a powerful thing when people can see themselves in others. Think about that. What's the most powerful thing? I'll bet every one of you can go back and think of a time in your life where there was a teacher, a family member, a neighbor, somebody who made you believe that you could be whatever you wanted to be. It's a powerful, powerful, powerful notion. That's one of the reasons I believe so strongly that we needed a court that looks like America, not just the Supreme Court.
What do you think, Amber, about representation here? What does it mean now to have a woman entering the U.S. Supreme Court? Is that going to make a black woman on the U.S. Supreme Court? What does that mean for your efforts to maybe bring a new generation of lawyers into the field?
Well, Wahl is always looking to encourage younger people. That's why we have the Vallandale Scholarship dinner every year, trying to encourage not only law students, so people already pursuing the legal career, but also talking at schools, talking to that next generation. I think it's super important to make it so that people can see themselves in other professionals. And I know growing up, I'm from the Milwaukee area, but I don't think I met another black judge until I was probably in college or law school. So making sure that those people who have already gone into roles that maybe these kids would be interested in are visible, are around, and are able to go into those positions of power is so important.
What do we lose in the legal field if we don't have, say, black women as attorneys, as judges?
I think that it's always really important to have a broad range of experiences and backgrounds, because I think that allows people to approach situations differently, which I think is really important, especially like in the judiciary, in those arenas. I also think it adds a layer of legitimacy to the courts. If people can go into court and see people who look like them making decisions that are important in their lives.
We're talking to Amber Rafit August, president of the Wisconsin Association of African American Lawyers, or WAAL, attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, talking about the confirmation of Judge, now Justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have a reaction or a question for our guest. As President Biden mentioned, this is one judge, one justice on the Supreme Court. You mentioned there's a lot of work to do. What do you see as the next steps?
In terms of next steps, I think it's basically what's been happening, encouraging more diverse candidates to run for judges and other positions, encouraging more people who have diverse backgrounds, especially black women or black girls to go into the law, to continue to diversify on that level. I think that until it is still, it's still not very representative of the population as a whole. We're still a very small but powerful group, but making sure that people understand that they can not necessarily get to the Supreme Court, but they have a role, they have a space in the legal field.
I've talked to guests in the past about science and technology and the obstacles for women, where you go, you have this pipeline problem where at each step along the way, women are kind of filtered away from science and technology. Are there similar, I guess, pipeline problems like that for black women getting into law? Where do you see some of the biggest roadblocks?
I think it starts really from the beginning. I think they're more less likely to have lawyers in their family, maybe. They're less likely to be exposed to the law at just an early age. It's not necessarily a career that they are told that they can get into. I don't think that it was even on the radar for me until high school, when a teacher randomly said, "You seem like someone who would be a good attorney." And the thought had not even crossed my mind in the slightest. So I think even from the beginning, there's those issues. And then there's also the issues of just societal issues, like lack of access to quality education, depending on the schooling systems, or an economic factor. Law school is extremely expensive, or even just women in general, by the time, you know, they maybe would be getting into these positions, maybe they're starting a family or they're taking time off for a leave related to having children or other family pressures, I think, too, that limit their ascension into some of these roles.
What kind of things do you think your group and others could do to reach into schools to tell the next Amber, hey, maybe you could be a lawyer?
I think it's a lot of what we've been doing is partnering with different groups and schools. Like, for example, we do a costume drive for Halloween at the YMCA or the YWCA in Madison for the different housing programs for kids. Just the exposure of seeing those kids, for example, and they're little, seeing the Black professionals come in and give them like their Black Panther costume or their Minnie Mouse or things like that. So continuing to make those contacts. And what Wall always finds is that there's always teachers, social workers, there's always people who want to reach out on the other end. So it's really about building those connections.
And the next step, somebody who's an attorney, maybe a Black woman who's an attorney, making that step to going into being a judge, seeing an open either appointment for an open seat or, as you were saying earlier, an open election. What kind of things can you do at that step of the pipeline?
So Wall specifically has a judicial pipeline program where we do use our collection of the Black judges who are so gracious with their time and expertise to assist other Wall members who might have questions and be interested. And also just generally, I've found that all of the diverse judges that we have in Wisconsin are usually pretty open about their journeys and assisting in terms of providing advice and other things. So I think it's really about, again, about those connections and making sure that those types of spaces exist for people who would be in like more diverse backgrounds to have access to those people who've done it before and have done it to the point where they've won elections. They're holding those seats that you might aspire to.
Let's bring on a caller. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I have 6 kids. 5 of them are multiracial. Of those 5, 4 of them are girls. I just think it's fantastic, you know, the diversity that I'm able to actually, so I can say to my kids, you can be whatever you want to be in this world. And I actually have concrete examples that I can point to and say, see, it's, you know, not that they couldn't have broken the ceiling, but it's just nice to have that. You know, you have Obama has already been president. You have Kamala Harris as vice president. You know, you had Hillary Clinton running as the first female, you know, like major party candidate. And now this. I just think it's fantastic. And it also makes me think of the woman who's the head of the Wisconsin Army National Guard. She's the first female general. And she has a quote, which is, if you don't have a seat at the table, you might be on the menu.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Amber, as we wrap up, is that the message you're hoping parents and their children are picking up here?
Yes. I also am biracial. And as a child, if I had the examples that we have now, it would have meant so much to me. I mostly had like Scary Spice from the Spice Girls. So in terms of representation, it's such a step forward. And I'm so excited to show my own girls, like, here are the examples of what Black women are doing out here today.
Marcus, thanks for that call. And Amber, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amber Rafit August, president of the Wisconsin Association of African American Lawyers. We talked to her about Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation to join the U.S. Supreme Court, what that means for Black women in the legal field here in the state. Coming up, we're going to talk about Jackson's experience as a public defender and how that fits her on the bench among her new colleagues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow the confirmation hearings, especially the parts that talked about her background as a public defender? Do you think that is a valuable thing to have in your resume if you want to serve on the nation's highest court, or do you have concerns about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about the confirmation of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to become the next justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now we're going to look at what it means to have a new justice on the court with experience as a public defender. You could join in with your thoughts or questions about that at 800-642-1234. Former public defenders on the U.S. Supreme Court, very few and far between. What do you think about that? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. John Gross is Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project. He teaches criminal law, criminal defense, and trial practice. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
Now, public defenders are guaranteed for the accused by the 6th Amendment to the Constitution. In this confirmation process, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's stint as a public defender got some criticism, some critical questions from Republicans in particular. What were your thoughts as that confirmation was going on?
Well, I thought it was really unfortunate that some of the Republican senators tried to exploit her past history as a public defender for political advantage, especially because those senators, particularly senators like Cruz and Hawley, they are actually lawyers. And they know very well that the Sixth Amendment requires representation. And they also know that legal ethics make it very clear that when a lawyer elects to represent someone, they are not endorsing that person's worldview or behavior or values. And so I think a good bit of that criticism was really unfair.
Now, I said few and far between former public defenders on the high court, very much so. And I think I saw a statistic, something like 1% of judges in the appellate court system, former public defenders, something like 8% in the entire system of federal judges. This is pretty rare. Why do we have so few former public defenders in these positions?
Yeah, the federal bench especially has a real prosecutorial government lawyer bias. It's at least 4-1. And part of the problem is historically, being a prosecutor has been this path to being a judge, whether elected or appointed. It has been the practice for a very long time. And the current administration is really trying to push back a little bit on that. They're trying to appoint a more diverse bench, one that's more representative of not just different racial and ethnic groups, but also of different practice areas, people who've done different types of law, including criminal defense.
Why does it matter if there are public defenders in our court system and on the U.S. Supreme Court, for that matter?
Well, when a lawyer represents the government, their client is sort of an abstraction. They're representing the state, or if they're a corporate lawyer, they're representing a corporation. But public defenders, they represent real people. They represent poor people, and they have a window into the challenges and the struggles of folks who live in poverty and folks who live in places where there are high crime rates. And I actually thought, there were comments about public defenders somehow siding with criminals. I have to say, it really is just the opposite. Public defenders have a front row seat to people who live in impoverished areas who are accused of crimes, but also victims of crime. So they are a very empathetic group. And I think empathy is a really critical thing to have when you're judging someone.
It does, especially if you are in an elected race for judge, it does give some easy campaign ad fodder, right? Because if you're a public defender, you will have defended guilty people at some point, and it's easy to bring that up. Is that part of the obstacle in our judge pipeline?
That is definitely part of the problem. And you see it not just with judicial appointments. You will see these type of attack ads when somebody runs for legislative office as well. And when they do happen, I hope people pay attention and notice that those attack ads are usually criticized quite harshly by state and local bar associations as being unfair. And in fact, it is a real... It's very discouraging to see that somebody's work in public service as a public defender somehow is manipulated into a character flaw when they attempt to seek elected office or be appointed to the bench.
We're talking to John Gross from the University of Wisconsin Law School, director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the role of public defenders in our legal system. Supreme Court Justice just confirmed Ketanji Brown Jackson's background as a public defender for a while in her career. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Arena. Jack, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jack?
Hey, I was talking about public defenders. I call it public pretenders. I've lived my whole life. I'm in my 60s. I'm retired now. And I got caught up, and I had a little legal problem. What I realized, the only thing that public defenders do is make a deal with the DA to keep the charge from going to court. They rarely go out of their way to defend the accused people.
Jack, thanks for the call. John, I know there's concern that public defenders are often spread thin. Jack says they don't want to have to take time in a courtroom. What do you think of what Jack had to bring up from his experience?
Well, I want to say it's certainly not the first time that I've heard someone express those opinions. I was a public defender myself for about 8 years. When I did a good job for clients, they often asked me when I was going to become a real lawyer. So there is that perception. I understand that. But in my experience, the public defenders who I've worked with and who I train are incredibly dedicated folks. You hit the nail on the head. The problem is one of resources and caseload. And public defenders are asked to represent a lot of folks and not always given the resources they need to do as good a job as they would like.
Thanks for the call, Jack. John, I remember at one point in the confirmation process, one senator mentioning, saying something along the lines of, you know, if you would have represented these people as a public defender, well, you might have even represented Nazis in the Nuremberg trial. Now, the Nazis, I believe, did have a legal defense representation. That was part of the point, right?
Yes, that is a bit of the irony of that statement. I don't want to misattribute it to a particular senator, but I do recall it being made. The Supreme Court justice who left to oversee the Nuremberg trials did so because he very much wanted to ensure that anyone who was accused of these horrific crimes were given due process. And that included being given lawyers to represent them during these trials. So, it's sort of disheartening to see this become something that United States senators will try to use to political advantage. This is a fundamental right tied to due process. And in fact, when the Gideon decision was made, which granted people the right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment, the justice who wrote that decision said, you know, the right to counsel may not be deemed fundamental in some countries, but it is in ours. And so we're really talking about a fundamental American value that really everybody should be on board with.
And in our last minute or so, John, criminal cases are only one part of what the U.S. Supreme Court does. What do you think would be the impact of having somebody, again, with a few years of public defender experience might be when those cases do come to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think that we've already seen a judge on the court, Justice Sotomayor, who practiced as a prosecutor in state-level criminal courts. And I think having a working knowledge of the criminal justice system, not what it says in the law books, not what it says in the statutes, but how it actually plays out on court, how police officers behave, how prosecutors actually behave, that's really critical for making decisions about whether or not somebody's constitutional rights have been violated. And so I think that perspective will just be invaluable to the other members of the court.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, talking about the newest U.S. Supreme Court justice just confirmed, Ketanji Brown Jackson, her background as a public defender and what that means for the court system and why judges with that kind of experience are few and far between.